Oh, no, it's not. You're right. Okay.
You know what? It works simple and it works.
That's what matters.
All right. Want to get ready? Okay. Welcome, everyone, to Astronomy on Tap, our April edition. This is our final Astronomy on Tap of the season. And our speaker today is Dr. Joanna Ridge, who comes to us by way of the University of Illinois, where she has her bachelor's degree, and also Kent State University, where she did her PhD on galaxies. She came here last year to start a postdoctoral research scholar appointment with Dr. Venable Wirta, where she's still working on galaxies, and she's going to talk to us today about the galaxies that are related to what she works on, the early galaxies.
Don't start clapping yet. Jesus. Okay.
So I'm really excited to be able to talk to you guys about some cosmology stuff. I don't know about you guys, but some of the first things that really got me interested in astronomy, even when I was really young, were questions about how did we come to be? Why is the universe? I don't know. I was a very deep child. But interestingly enough, these questions have kind of persisted. I'll forewarn you that the topic is not totally, this is not totally what I research except for the part right at the end. But these are the questions that I always come back to and I always find the most fascinating. So hopefully you guys will learn something. And feel free to ask any questions while I'm going and speak. Very casual. So without further ado, let me go ahead and get started. So I'm going to talk about the early universe from the Big Bang to the first galaxy. So that's about 5 million years. You might think I've bit off more than I can chew, and you're probably right. But we're gonna give it our best shot. So this is the roadmap for the evening. We're going to answer this question, what is dark energy? Actually, spoiler alert, we're not going to answer that question. But we'll talk about it. We'll discuss the question of what is dark matter. Spoiler alert, we're also not going to answer that question. There's a theme, are you getting it? Then we'll just go, brief history of the universe kind of thing. That won't take long at all. And then, finally, and if we have time, and if I haven't been overly ambitious with my talk tonight, I'll actually talk a little bit about the research that I do looking for the very first galaxies that we're able to see in the universe. So, what is dark energy? Well, let me give you a little bit of the history of kind of modern cosmology. So as I was going over my talk earlier, I realized that I was not totally fair in starting off with Edwin Hubble, who some of you may know is actually a local. And I met a relative of him at a restaurant, 6 weeks ago. Side note. Anyway, actually, I believe he was French. Lemaitre, was he French?
Belgium.
Belgium. I don't know that he was an astronomer per se, perhaps a physicist. He theoretically, Georges Lemaitre, predicted via math and theory, who does that, that there might be this idea that the universe is expanding. Unfortunately for him, this idea didn't really take hold until Edwin Hubble came along. He was working in the Mount Wilson Observatory, which is a 100 centimeter, I think. 100 inch. Oh, excuse me, yeah. Imperial units. 100 inch telescope, which by today's standards is tiny. And he was taking what was at the time some of the best images of galaxies. And what he was trying to do was answer this what was known as kind of the great debate of the 1920s. As to whether these kind of fuzzy things that people were seeing that they called nebulae, were they inside the Milky Way or were they outside the Milky Way? And this debate raged on, and Hubble was trying to kind of help trying to figure out the distances to these nebulae, what we now know are actually galaxies that are very distant from us. They're in no way within our own Milky Way galaxy. And so he determined that many galaxies, among them the Andromeda galaxy, which some of you may be familiar with, are indeed outside of the Milky Way. He determined that the Andromeda galaxy was about 900,000 light years outside of the Milky Way. Something to keep in mind, he was actually super wrong. The Andromeda galaxy is over 2 million light years away. And this will come back to, well, we'll come back to haunt him. I don't think he doesn't care anymore, but this will affect some of his results. So he determined that these galaxies, what he actually found in this relationship, which we now know as Hubble's law, it's a linear relationship that says that the velocity of galaxies is proportional to the distance. In other words, the farther away a galaxy is, the faster away from us its recessional velocity, the faster its velocity is. He published this in 1929 and followed it up with several other works. And basically what this says is, what he determined was that that must mean that the universe is expanding. If the farther away a galaxy is from us, the faster it's moving, that means that the space-time in which it exists, if you will, is expanding. And so this is this famous Hubble's law, where velocity is this recessional velocity. Hubble's constant is basically the slope of this relationship, if you will, and the distance are the distance to the galaxy. And this Hubble's constant is basically contains what we know about the rate of expansion of the universe. And the value of Hubble's constant has been a hot topic ever since the 1930s. Hubble himself pinned it down at about 500 kilometers per second per megaparsec, where a megaparsec is 1 million parsecs, and a parsec is about 3 light years. So when we talk about these vast distances of the universe, we usually quantify it in megaparsecs because we're talking really large distances. Okay. So as I said, Hubble originally thought that this was called Hubble constant, or H naught, was 500 kilometers per second per megaparsec. However, it turns out, and you remember I said, that he didn't do a good job pinning down these distances to the galaxies. Some of them, well, truthfully, actually all of them were totally wrong. These galaxies, it turns out their distances are like outside the building over there, if you will. He thought distances of like 1 megaparsec, 2 megaparsec. In actuality, these distances, this is an updated Hubble's law plot, where if you look, we're talking now on a scale of 100, 200, 300 megaparsecs. So to give you a sense of scale, that little square there is actually bigger than Hubble's original data. So this concept, so actually Hubble was really lucky, because he could have been just totally wrong. And it turns out he was actually right purely by luck. Well, I won't say purely, that's unfair. He was really lucky, though, that he turned out to be right, and that this relation is actually a really important relation to understand the cosmology and the idea that the universe is expanding. So nowadays, given the most updated information, which I'll talk about some of these experiments later, we know, we think, that Hubble's constant is about 67, 68. So that's very different from 500. And really cool, like we know it really well. Like plus or minus 1.2 is a really good error estimate. And I'll talk a little bit about where that comes from later. So, Hubble showed us, or proved to us, that the universe is expanding. Well, where do we go from there? There were a couple of experiments in the 90s, the High-Z Supernova Search and the Supernova Cosmology Project, that basically took the same kind of idea of what Hubble was doing, trying to determine the distances to galaxies, and they were looking for a certain kind of supernova. You guys want to know what a supernova is? Not talking grad students. Right, supernova is a star that explodes at the end of its lifetime. These people were looking for very specific types of these stellar explosions. That can be referred to as standard candles. Like we think we really know how bright they are, no matter what distance we put them at. And these two projects kind of simultaneously discovered that actually the universe is not only expanded, but the expansion is accelerating. So it's getting bigger at a faster rate than it was in the past. And if you think about it, this is weird. And I'll tell you why. So let's think about what it means for the universe to be expanding. So what I'm showing here is a plot of the average distance between galaxies, or what you could think of as the expansion rate of the universe, versus the time of existence, where now is zero, and you go to negative, and that's the past, and positive, that's the future. So there's four different options shown on this figure of what the universe might have done in the past and what it might do in the future. The first option is what's called an open universe. They've labeled it coasting here. In other words, the universe continues to expand at a constant rate forever and ever into the future. Pretty, probably the most boring option.
We don't
want to
be boring.
God forbid. The second option is what we call a flat universe. So you can think of it as we have just enough mass in the universe that the universe expands, but the gravitational pull of all the matter in the universe slowly causes that expansion to slow down until it slowly just kind of goes to zero if you went off to infinity. That's called a flat universe, or a universe with a critical density, if you're familiar with that terminology. Finally, a closed universe. You might have heard this referred to as the Big Crunch, or a recollapsing universe, where the universe starts with the Big Bang, the universe expands, and then as the matter kind of pulls on space-time, the matter in the universe causes the universe to gradually fall back in on itself. So, is that clear? It's basically the gravitational pull of the matter in the universe causes it to fall back in on itself. Which I think would make the most sense. Yes?
How do you explain black holes and what does that do?
So it's kind of a different concept.
I heard they stress the light.
Yeah, they do. For the purposes of this topic, black holes are kind of a different beast, if you will. Like, we're talking all the matter in the universe ever. Black holes have perhaps a more localized effect than what we're talking about here. Yeah?
Your question, I think I need to understand one thing here. So, matter on matter, pulls on each other, how?
Gravitationally.
So with gravitational waves and gravitational attraction and all that, how does that happen across parsecs in a vacuum of space?
Right, so this comes back to what we call the inverse square law, which basically says the effect of gravity goes as the square of the distance between two objects. So if you think about it, there's actually an infinitesimal gravitational pull between every single bit of matter in the universe. It just goes down as the square of the distance between whatever. Yes. I mean, then you have to think about, like, okay, does that really count if you're talking about, two objects that are really close to each other, like, say, us and the sun? You know, the gravitational pull of a very distant galaxy across the universe is going to have a very negligible effect, comparatively. But technically, if you want to be technical, it's still there, yeah. So that's the idea, though. I mean, this gravity, negligible though it might be between any two given objects, should summed together have the ability to pull space-time back in on itself. That's the general idea. Yeah?
I'm curious about the rate of expansion within 10 million years. I don't know. I don't mean this to be 100. So how do they calculate that actually? I mean, if you're born within our lifetime,
so, like, how much will it expand in the 100 years in your... I don't know the answer to that question. I could do math if you gave me enough time. It's hard to wrap your head around, though. Yeah. I mean, you know.
Well, the novel kind of just did it, and you just kind of hit it a little bit ago with that little comment.
Sure.
Is that the rate of expansion?
Yeah, so if you figured out how many seconds you have in your lifetime,
well, yeah,
you'd do some math.
But that basically is on a time scale.
You could figure it out. Yeah, exactly. Of course, the question then becomes, has Hubble's constant always been constant? Or is it only constant right now?
Sure.
Blow your mind. Yes.
So was it initially assumed that we were expanding at a constant velocity before they came to the conclusion that we were accelerating?
So, no. Before Lemaître, the idea was that the universe was static. I mean, why would we think that anything was moving, right? Like, we could barely figure out that we were going around the sun going, you know, so the idea of a static universe, and some people held on to it. I was actually reading in my research that very well-known astronomer Fred Hoyle, until his death, refused to believe that, you know, in 2001 that the universe was expanding, much less accelerating. So, you know, everything that I'm hearing, saying here, you should take a bigger salt, basically. I mean, we have very good reason for thinking that what we think is true, but, you know,
we're scientists, right? We should always think these things through.
Okay, so, right, then you have this idea that we might live in an accelerating universe. In other words, not only is the universe expanding, but it is speeding up in its expansion. If you think about the gravitational pull of all the matter in the universe, it doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense. So these supernova data that I was telling you about, we plot. So this is basically a version of this Hubble's law. You'll notice if you're paying attention that the axes are actually different quantities. But the idea is essentially the same. And what we found is that our data tell us that we live barely in an accelerating universe. Why do we live in an accelerating universe?
Your guess is as good as anybody's these days.
So we attribute this accelerating expansion to a negative pressure, if you will, that we call dark energy. And that's about all I have to say about dark energy. Because that's about all we know.
There's not enough energy that we can account for to account for this expansion.
Maybe you might be confusing with concept of dark matter, which I'm going to get to. But the idea is that why is the universe accelerating in its expansion? In its expansion, particularly with the pull of all the matter within it, we don't know. And we attribute that to an energy. Yes?
So isn't this acceleration an effect of the Big Bang?
It's not a requirement of the Big Bang, but there are theories that kind of sum it all together. I'm not going to get into cosmology mostly because I don't know it, but there's this idea that there's a cosmological constant, if you will. It was actually kind of predicted by Einstein's theory of general relativity, in which he refused to believe for a couple decades. Yeah. Beyond that, we're getting outside everything from my mind. Yeah.
Is dark matter what the universe is expanding into, or what is outside the universe that we're expanding into?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that the answer is not dark matter, so I'm going to talk about dark matter next.
So what are we expanding into? I mean, what's outside the universe?
We're just getting bigger.
How? There's got to be something outside.
I'm not qualified. I have a hard time wrapping my brain around some of this stuff.
We all do.
Do we have to be expanding into anything? Like, the whole concept of space-time doesn't exist outside.
It has to expand into something.
Does it though?
Well, that's a different, that's a localized kind of thought.
If Earth was expanding and you just had a boat and a car, then you could go around the Earth and measure the size without leaving Earth. But if you didn't have a plane, you couldn't, or a rocket, you couldn't go off and get out of it. So our universe is a 3D version of that. And you can't leave our universe. You can't get out of it. We know how big it is, but you can't get out of it.
I'm just trying to ask, what is expanding into?
Vacuum.
We don't know.
It might not even just space out there.
It's in vacuum. Vacuum is kind of big. So.
Yeah, you can't leave our universe. So you can't define the
universe.
Okay, back to work.
Okay.
Basically, you can't get it.
We will leave any more discussion about dark energy to when we get to our second tier. Okay, so the only other thing I'll say about dark energy is that these teams, Adam, led by Adam Reese in particular, won a Nobel Prize for this work not so long ago. Okay, so we're going to move away from dark energy and we're going to pretend that we know how to answer the question, what is dark matter? So, to answer this question, we have to have another history lesson. I actually think the history of this stuff is really interesting. So this character, named Fritz Zwicky, actually had quite a reputation. Word on the street is that nobody really liked him. I mean, he's a bit of an abrasive character, but he was super smart. And he worked at Caltech, and in the 30s, he was studying what's called a coma cluster, which is a cluster of galaxies. Basically, a cluster of galaxies, this is the coma cluster here, is a collection, if you will, of a lot of galaxies that are gravitationally bound to each other. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're orbiting any central object, like a solar system, for example. They're just gravitationally bound and kind of moving together within the gravitational field of each other. So he was doing some work on the coma cluster, which has about 1,000 galaxies. And what he did was he was looking at what we call the Doppler shift of the light from the galaxies. You guys know the concept, right? There's an emergency vehicle passing you, and as it comes towards you, it sounds really high pitched, and it's away from you, the sound seems to get lower pitched. And this is basically the concept of the Doppler shift, except for, in this case, sound wave. So as the object is moving towards you, the object is emitting the sound waves get compressed, and so you hear them at a higher frequency. And then as it moves away from you, the opposite happens, the sound waves get elongated, and that frequency lowers, and you hear it at a lower pitch. The same thing happens with light. So Fritz Zwicky was looking at the light from these galaxies. More specifically, he was looking at specific features, and he found that he was able to measure that the shift in the light features, basically, and through that was able to determine the velocity of the galaxy. So in the same way that if you measured the sound waves from a vehicle passing you, you could actually measure the speed of it. Just by how much the sound waves are compressed. And so the same idea is true with these galaxies. So he was able to measure the velocity of these galaxies, and from that, he was able to measure the total mass of this cluster. So in other words, how much mass do you need to keep all of these 1,000 galaxies gravitationally bound together? And so he determined this total mass, or virial mass, if you will, for this cluster. From there, he then looked at just the light, and I'm not going to get into the science of how you do this, but from the light, you can basically measure the mass of these galaxies that is made up of visible mass. And so then you can compare the total mass that you would need for this cluster to keep it gravitationally bound to the visible light, the visible mass of the galaxies within the cluster, and he found that to keep this cluster bound together, there was not enough visible mass in the cluster. So in other words, at the velocities that these galaxies were moving, they should be shooting out of the cluster and not remain gravitationally bound together. And he attributed this to dark matter, that's what he called it. There must be some kind of matter in the cluster that he was not able to see, was not visible to him, and he knew from the physics that it had to exist. Because otherwise, how was that cluster remaining gravitationally bound? And this concept has been shown in every cluster. It's been proven. It was not like this cluster is random. This has been carried out. And it's shown to be true for a lot of gravitational systems. So this is kind of the first inkling that there was some kind of matter that we were not able to interact with our eyes. It had no electromagnetic radiation. It was found later that the only way that it interacts with our universe is through gravity. Which makes it very hard to detect. Because if you put out a detector, say a CCD for example, like how you take pictures with your iPhone, a dark matter particle that only interacts gravitationally is not going to touch your CCD sensor. So how do you figure out what it is if you can't touch it and you can't see it? And that's kind of a big issue with searches for dark matter. We've been able to find other evidence for dark matter, if you will. So, for example, simulations of galaxies cannot replicate the kind of morphologies or shapes of galaxies that we see. So these spirals, these ellipticals, you know, we get these beautiful pictures taken with, for example, Hubble Space Telescope. How do galaxies, we cannot simulate these shapes of galaxies. We cannot put in a bunch of fake particles and create a simulation and end up with what we see in the real world unless we include this kind of uniform background mass that's about 10 times what we see in the visible universe. Also, it's been found that galaxies rotate much faster at the edges. So, for example, these spiral galaxies are actually spinning. Our own Milky Way is spinning up, if you will. You can kind of think of the angular momentum of a figure skater, right? When they do these curves and they've got the...
So that's actually spinning clockwise?
Counterclockwise?
Okay. You said the outer is moving faster than the inner. And I'm just kind of wondering.
It's not necessarily moving faster than the... Well, actually... It is. My point was that it's moving faster than it should, given the radius that it's at, based on Newtonian physics. So this is just another kind of piece of the puzzle that tells us there's matter in these galaxies that is making, is causing the rotation curves, as we call this plot here, where what we observe is that it's much faster than what we would expect from Newtonian physics. So we're having trouble finding dark matter, but there are many avenues through which we know it exists, and through which we see its effects. Now, people have posited that perhaps we don't understand how gravity works on large scales, called modified Newtonian dynamics, or MOD. Most people don't think that's true because it would kind of ruin everything about Einstein's gravitational relativity work, which really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. There's always a few people who every time something weird happens, like, well, maybe it's MOD. As scientists, we have to think these things through. But most people will tell you that it's likely there's a particle out there that exists that we just haven't been able to detect yet. So, that's all I'm going to say about dark matter. I know I'm leaving you with a lot of questions, but welcome to my world. So, let's instead go wandering through the history of the universe. So in other words, I want to tell you a little bit about how we actually do some of this early this cosmology work. Like, how do we know what has happened? What happened 13 point however many billion years ago? How do we know that the universe started from a Big Bang, which, side note, is really a misnomer. How do we know that it started from an infinitesimal point and grew out from that? It's like, well, you know, nobody was there, right? But we have a lot of evidence that can tell us, can give us insight into what happened. I'm going to talk about one of the kind of coolest successes of modern cosmology. So you might have seen this picture before. It's a very oft-used diagram, if you will, of the history of the universe. Here we are. This is the Big Bang when we were very wee. And then the universe inflated. Not going to talk about inflation because that could be a whole talk that I would not qualify for. After inflation, we have what's called the recombination, era of recombination. So in other words, everything was really hot and really dense. The universe was a plasma. Everything just kind of was like energy. And then as the universe expanded, it cooled down. And it cooled down enough that particles started to combine. So instead of just like a soup of quark, we had electrons and protons, and they started to recombine. I'm going to talk about this more, but from there, we have this kind of cosmic dark ages for about 5 million years, where we don't know what happened because the universe was opaque to us. It was so dense that no light could get out from there. So even if we could look back that far, which our modern day technology is trying really hard, but not quite there, we wouldn't be able to see any light from that era. Then, the first star, about 4 or 5 million years ago, started to form and reionize the universe, and so it became opaque to light again. And I'm going to talk about that when I get to my research. And from there, the universe evolved. Okay. So I want to talk about this kind of background radiation, and it's called the cosmic microwave background. And of course, as I'm wont to do, a small history lesson. This faint radiation left from the Big Bang can actually be measured in the 60s. Well, to be fair, it was posited a couple decades before the 60s, but kind of as a side note in a random journal article. And so people kind of forgot this concept of this kind of weird background radiation that is measurable everywhere you look in the universe. And in 1964, Penzias and Wilson, they were working for Bell Labs, were looking at this, this is a radio telescope, if you can believe it, and they were trying to measure faint radio waves bouncing off satellites. I don't know why they were trying to do that. But the point was, is that they were really faint radio waves. And so they had to remove all sources of noise that could possibly interfere with their measurements. And after doing that, they found this steady, low-frequency noise that persisted in their radio receiver. They even went so far as to go clean out a bunch of pigeon nests, because they thought maybe it was pigeons that were like placing, you know, all up in their antenna. Turns out, they found that there was a steady cosmic microwave background at 2.7 Kelvin, which, if you're not familiar with the Kelvin system, that's what, minus 264 degrees Celsius. So, really cold, but measurable. This is not actually a real measurement, this is just a shape I put on here. But it gives you the idea that everywhere you look, you see this 2.7 Kelvin signal. And so, when was COBE launched?
1989.
Okay. The cosmic, I wrote this down, Cosmic Background Explorer. So COBE was this first kind of satellite that was put up to measure the microwave background. So this is what they saw. Artist rendition. I'm the artist. So then what they did is, well, okay, let's subtract this 2.7. Basically, take an average. I don't know if this is exactly what they did, but this is what I would have done. Take an average of all the measurements and subtract it and see if you can find any variation. So they did that. This is actually real. I think this is not artist rendition. It's also not a, what's the yin and yang, anyway, this is what we call a dipole. change in temperature between the red and the blue is 3.6 microkelvin, no, millikelvin. And this is basically generated from the fact that our galaxy is moving through the universe. So as we move forward, you get a warmer microwave background, and as it recedes from us, we get a slightly cooler microwave background. So subtract off the dipole. Can you guess what that is? This red thing? It's our galaxy. Always getting in the way of our observations. So this temperature is from our own Milky Way. So if we want to understand more about the variations in the cosmic microwave background, we have to subtract that off as well. So this is kind of the coup de grace of COBE. We're talking temperature variations here down in the microkelvin region. So 10 to the minus 6. That may seem pretty like insignificant, right? Like that is a tiny temperature variation. But the amount of cosmology, the amount of information about our early universe and what happened in the early universe that's encoded in this is mind-blowing, at least to me. So next, the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, or WMAP, was kind of the next step up from COBE. And this is the final map that was put out by WMAP of the cosmic microwave background. The same variation kind of in temperature, but what you're starting to see here is a lot higher resolution. You can actually get at these fluctuations in a much more, you can kind of believe those fluctuations a lot more than you can, for example, when you're looking at something like that.
How do you determine the edge of that? Are you've got this picture.
Yeah.
And it's a map of what space? Is it?
It's everything.
360 degrees?
It's 360
degrees,
yeah.
So
it was a satellite they put up and it looked everywhere.
Okay, so the edges of the map are what?
So think of like a globe, right?
Yeah.
Like when you cut it up, it kind of, you know, you get these projections. Imagine like it's everything that we look out except for flattened on the screen.
In a way, that's inverted, circle, oval. You're stepping into it and looking in whatever direction you're looking. It should be a complete sphere around yourself.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so that should actually be kind of a sphere around.
Yeah. Okay, and then finally we have the Planck mission, which just wrapped up, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years ago now. And you can see, this is incredible, the resolution that we have on the anisotropies, the inhomogeneities, or the temperature variations of this cosmic microwave background. I thought about getting really mathy on you guys, so I've decided to spare you. But if you want to ask about it later, I have some more plots. The thing that's really cool about the cosmic microwave background, though, is that from it, that's how we determine things like, you've probably seen this pie chart, right? Like 72% of the energy in our universe, it has to be attributed to dark energy. 23% dark matter. These are a little outdated, but still, they're basically the same. 4.6 matter percent of matter in the universe is matter that we actually interact with. So, you know, 95% of the universe you can't see, touch, or feel. I don't know if that bothers you guys. It's a little weird. You know, we can also tell simply from the CMB maps that we were looking at how it was 13.7 million years ago when the universe started. This stuff is really cool, and it's also, like, I think one of the big successes of modern cosmology. So, I'm not a CMB expert by any stretch of the imagination, but if you want to talk a little bit more about how we get from those temperature variation maps to knowing things like this, we can talk about it.
Okay, but the obvious thing here is that there's no dark energy present 13.7 billion years ago.
Right.
There's a whole lot today.
Yeah.
That's obvious.
Right. work. I've told you everything I know about dark energy.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the first one, 13.7 billion years ago, what kind of atoms or elements are we dealing with?
You're talking about protons. You're talking about electrons.
So they're not even in a periodic table material yet.
Because that stuff was formed from the first stars exploding and going supernovae. Yeah. So things like iron and silicon and carbon and oxygen, none of that existed in the early universe.
But hydrogen would be a proton, right?
Hydrogen,
yeah, is a proton. Yeah.
Is there something called the Oort cloud? And if there is, would you explain that to
me? Yes, so the Oort cloud exists outside of our solar system. So it's a much smaller scale than what we've been talking about here. And it's thought to be, remnants of the formation of our own solar system.
I was under the impression it was the edge of the universe, so I got it wrong.
Yeah, edge of our solar system.
Edge of our solar system.
And it's just stuff out from, you know, that existed kind of out in the edges of when our own solar system formed, when our own star formed, our sun. That just never got bound up in anything like a planet, for example. Yeah. No, so these are just percentages of, well, okay, let me think about that. No. So the total has to be the same. But what, I don't know. Because the dark energy didn't exist, because where is it coming from?
Well, it's only a little teeny tiny piece.
It just affects, so here we're not necessarily, this is not necessarily just matter, this is, you can think of this as like matter, energy. Right.
It's like per cubic meter, the density.
Yeah, and so the other thing you have to think about is the volume of the universe will expand. So if you
look at the atom, there's 12%.
Right, so that's just the percentage. That's back then, it took up a larger fraction of what exists from now.
So that could be because of volume.
Yeah, but also dark energy.
Okay,
no, these are good questions. This stuff is really challenging for me because, like I said, it gets at the end of the edges of what I know. So, okay. So now I get to talk about my own research. Maybe I can answer questions better about. Hopefully. Okay. So this is work that I started. When I was finishing up my PhD, I really was interested in kind of pushing the limit of how far out can we see galaxies? Because you guys are probably familiar with the concept of that light travels at a constant speed. And so the more distant a galaxy is that we're looking at, the longer ago the light that we're observing was emitted from that galaxy. So in other words, it's like looking back in time. So the more distant we look out in the universe for galaxies, we're actually seeing them as they were, however long ago that light was emitted, which could be some of the first light that was ever emitted from galaxies in the universe. And who doesn't want to look through a time machine, right? So I was really excited when this opportunity came along to kind of go hunting, galaxy hunting, if you will, for some of these first galaxies, with the idea of can we understand how these first galaxies came to be? How did we go from having no stars, no galaxies, to having these beautiful grand design spirals and ellipticals and irregular galaxies that we can see today more in our local neighborhood? So Hubble Space Telescope was launched in 1990. It was meant to be a 5-year mission, and it is still our best, I would say even among telescopes on the ground and telescopes in space, satellites, is really still, how many years ago was that now? 28 years is still our best way of kind of understanding the universe. Which, if you want to talk about return on investment, it's pretty darn good. So there's a one of the way that I use Hubble Space Telescope in my studies is I use what's called the wide field camera. It's currently in our third incarnation. Because Hubble is in a low Earth orbit, orbits the Earth every 90 minutes, it's actually a serviceable mission. So we can go up there and fix things or upgrade cameras and instruments, unlike some satellites, for example, that we put farther out from the Earth, and once they get out there, then we just hope they work and can't fix them. So this wide field camera has what we call different filters, much like you might have, if you're a fancy photographer, and you have your RGB filters, very similar to that kind of thing. At different wavelengths of light come through in different filters. And this is important because the amount of light that comes through at different wavelengths or different filters actually can really tell us something about the galaxies that we're observing. And I'll show you how that's true. Okay. This is a crappy little movie that I cannot find a better one. I was talking about Doppler shift earlier, and this movie is meant to kind of illustrate that for you, where you can see this is a spectrum here, right, from purple to red, and you've got these absorption features, which can kind of tell you, for example, what is the galaxy made up of. Is it made out of oxygen? You'll find an absorption feature in the spectrum, or an emission feature. As the object is moving away from us, however, the spectrum gets redshifted. So when we talk about looking at high redshift galaxies, that means their features have been shifted into the redder wavelength than where you see them if you measure them in a lab on the Earth. Does that make sense?
They're moving away from you.
Yes. It means they're moving away from us, but it also means the more redshift it is, because of Hubble, the farther away it is. So, I'm high redshift galaxy hunting is what I'm doing, basically. So the idea is here, just kind of in a more static method, you measure in a laboratory, you get these dark features in the blue and in the green, but when you go up to high redshift, they've shifted up here into the red. That's the idea. So, what I've got here is these are these filters we were looking at before. And this gray thing here is basically the light coming from a galaxy. And this is what it looks like in all these different bands. You can see the galaxy as it is in each of these bands. But as the galaxy moves to higher and higher redshift, and what? Aw, man. You guys really have to see this. Okay, hang on. Forget it. Okay, just bear with me here. Oh, that's not working. Okay. Hang on. Don't get car sick from this, you guys. Okay. You ready? This is gonna be good. Okay, here we go. Okay. Can you see that okay? Okay. So can you watch what's happening here? As the features move that way, basically the galaxy disappears from these bands. And that tells you something about what the redshift is of the galaxy. If you can see it in all of these bands, that means it's not a high redshift galaxy. But as you move that way, as the redshift gets higher, as the galaxy gets more distant, it drops out of these bands. This method for finding high redshift galaxies is called the dropout method. Does that make sense? Have I lost you? I'll show you how it works in real and roll life. Hang on. Now I gotta fix this. Okay. So here's some plots I made, 2 days ago. So these are a couple of my galaxies. Unfortunately, when you're looking at high-redshift galaxies, they're not very interesting. They're a few pixels. But you can see, not there, not there. Oh, look, it's starting to show up there. these are some of the first galaxies. These are galaxies that are so high redshift that according to cosmology, they have to be some of the first ones that ever formed. And we're seeing them right as they form, which I think is really cool. To be slightly more quantitative about it, and I won't bore you too much with it, but we can basically kind of take those pictures, put them in a 1D spectrum, fit the models to it, and figure out what redshifts they're at based on where they disappear from the filter. So this is some stuff I'm about to publish, hopefully. So the idea here is that, you know, this is basically that kind of cosmic timeline again. And with the work that I'm doing, we're trying to probe this what's called re-ionization, or when the universe went from that opaque dark age to kind of what we think of as the modern universe. Did it re-ionize patchily? Did it happen all at once? Did the galaxy emit a lot of radiation that was able to re-ionize it in bits and pieces? And those are kind of the questions we're trying to answer. So it's a little bit cosmology, it's a little bit astronomy, but that's kind of the stuff that we're trying to get at with what we're doing right now.
So, what's the furthest redshift from the found of the beginning of the universe?
Well, so we're never going to find the beginning of the universe, right? Because the first galaxy is formed much faster than the beginning of the universe. But I unfortunately do not hold the record of the highest redshift. There's some out there, redshift of like, I want to say there's a redshift 12 galaxy out there, which, you know, like, maybe it's real, maybe it's not. The problem is that some things can look like they're high redshift galaxies, but they might actually be like lower redshift interlopers that are just an asteroid. You have to be really careful in your analysis. So I should have said the redshifts of the galaxies I'm looking at are like redshift 8. So for you.
For an idiot, excuse me, redshift 8, what does that mean? How far away is that?
I can't tell you the distance scale, I can tell you the time scale. I can't tell you the time scale. What are we talking, maybe 12 billion, that sounds about right, so 12 billion years ago, so 1.5 billion years after the Big Bang. So it's not a linear, so the number of redshifts does not correspond linearly to how old the universe is. But yeah, so redshift 8 is about 12 billion years ago.
But 12 is
longer than
12
days. Yeah, I think. I'm not entirely sure. I'm getting your ass.
Oh, I mean, as a ship, if one is closer.
Yeah. Right, so you can technically redshift, so, you know, we talk about cosmologists in the very early universe talk about redshifts of like 1100. So, yeah, you can get a whole lot higher redshifts than 8, yeah. Let me just an impact there.
My question is, the redshift you guys are calculating, for instance, the instrument takes the measurement of the redshift, and then sends it down to whatever. And then that gets processed and calculated, and then it gets to you, the scientist. How long is that process? Or how long is the process until the answer comes out from the equipment that is in space?
I mean, how hard do you want me to work, man? So that's not quite how it goes. So what happens is if I were to put in a Hubble proposal, so Hubble, please give me time to look at my galaxy. They'd be like, okay, well, we can schedule you sometime in the next year. No. Probably what they say is no. 20% of lucky people, they'll say, sometime in the next year, basically. And so you may have to wait up to a year for them to take your data. Maybe more if something goes wrong. Once they take your data, you can kind of have it, right? Like it downlinks very, it's a low Earth orbit, it's almost immediate. You can go into the archives and get your data. And then you're limited only by how fast you want to work. planetary time. It could be 18 months to a couple years that you have, where it's like only you get to look at your data. You came up with the idea, you asked for the data, it got approved. It's your data. But the minute those 18 months are up, everybody is free game.
Dark matter doesn't emit any radiation. Is it possible that it absorbs radiation? Can you design some sort of long distance spectrometer
to
detect it by absorption?
So you're kind of on the right track. It's not an electromagnetic. So if something doesn't emit, it's not going to absorb. That's the same force. Yes, same color. Thank you. Kind of equal and opposite. However, depending on what your guess is for what dark matter is, so you think it's a wimp, a weakly interacting mass of particles, for example, you might be able to design an experiment that is a cryogenic way underground, an old mine shaft, for example, which is dumb. They just make that up. And maybe if it like weakly will interact with a very specific type of, what is it, germanium? What do they make these detectors out of for the CDMS? I can't remember.
Red?
I don't know. There's some, but you might have some hope that your weakly interacting mass of particles will interact.
Yeah,
those are kind of passe now. If you think it's an axion, you might have to look somewhere else. That's the edge of all I know. I know that axion is the only one. Yes.
I was just wondering, if the data from the James Webb Space Telescope one is launched, is that kind of what's going to change your field? I don't know if I mentioned that on you.
Yeah. So the James Webb Space Telescope, or JWST, we are hoping is going to revolutionize this kind of stuff, because right now what we're limited by is how red we can look with Hubble. So once you don't have any red filters left, you can't see any higher redshift, right? Because the features you're looking for in redshift is past what is available from the technology. So the James Webb Space Telescope is an infrared detector. So, instead of being limited at, say, 1.5 micron wavelength, we can look all the way up to 5 and beyond. That's the hope. JWST is...
It launched in a couple of years.
Sure. Yeah, it was recently delayed, but yeah. Yeah. I'll talk about it.
Yeah. I'm curious, on your slide there, the lower right, the slides that were listed, they all start with F, except for the first one, everything ends with a W. What did that stand for, just as a curiosity?
So, filter.
Okay.
This gives kind of a wavelength range, and LP is a long path filter, so it's really wide. So it collects photons of a very large swath of wavelength. W just means wide. W is wide. So just a naming convention for the filter. Yeah.
But as you're going across there, the ones on your right, which you don't have very good, there's not a lot of pixels. Is that because so far away in such a small area that you're looking at, is it just because it's...
Because they're small.
Okay, but the area you're looking at on all those, does it get smaller as you go there? Or does it, or is the field of view in each of those pretty much the same? Is that a picture of the field of view?
I know what you're asking. I'm trying to remember what I did. I accounted for the field of view. You're looking at comparable area. The one thing you will perhaps note is the pixel size is bigger in these ones than in these ones, and that has to do with the pixel scale of different filters available. Does that make sense?
Is it possible to use LIGO to measure the dark energy or dark matter?
Are you talking about the LIGO?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the fact that we detected gravitational waves is really cool, A, and also can tell us a lot about how dark energy works.
1 minute break, and people who want to go can go, and you can come up and talk to Joanna. I'd like to invite you to the Bullet Lecture in Astronomy on the Mysteries of the Dark Universe on October 4th in Planetarium. We will have Astronomy on Tap here starting in September. We're going to switch to Wednesdays. We're not sure which Wednesday will be. We'll try to avoid clashing with the one against the grain, which is the sort of the medical.